For those of you who are fairly new to us, we support various people throughout the world. It's our privilege today to hear from Justin Donner, a longtime missionary in France and soon to be in Germany. Justin has been with us in the past, and we're honored and thrilled that he's going to share a message for us today. Would you welcome him as he comes to our pulpit today?
Thank you. Good morning. Now, you may be wondering why I chose this passage this morning for our sermon. It's, let's be honest, it's a very harsh passage. Isaiah is not mincing words. And if you're wondering what this has to do with Christmas, or even what it has to do with grace, I can understand you. But I promise there is, in this passage, a lesson for us today. And it is, I promise, a lesson about grace. Now, Isaiah is sent by God to talk to this man whose name is Shebna. For once, Isaiah is not sent to Israel as a whole, but to just one man. And he has to deliver this very harsh message to him. Essentially, Isaiah is telling Shebna, look, you're fired. Pack up your stuff and get out of here. And at that time, Shebna is not just a random person in Israel. Shebna is a very high-ranking official. He is called in this prophecy the palace administrator. And that title doesn't mean much to us, but at the time, that would make Shebna one of the most powerful men in the kingdom. As palace administrator, Shebna is in charge of the kingdom's budget. He's in charge of collecting taxes, and he's in charge of spending the money that he collected. He's also in charge, well, of the palace, obviously, and he's in charge of the king's schedule. If someone in Israel wants to meet the king and ask something of the king, if someone wants to appeal to the king's justice, he has to ask Shebna first. You have to get his approval. And if Shebna doesn't like you, he can just say no, and you will never get to speak to the king. See, we don't really have an equivalent title today, but Shebna is kind of, he's a prime minister slash secretary slash best friend for the king. And so, yes, if Shebna dislikes you, he can very easily get you in trouble. He is a very important man, and to be honest, he's a very dangerous man. Shebna is not someone that you criticize out loud, not if you want to stay out of trouble. And yet, Isaiah walks into his office, and Isaiah does not mince words. Isaiah is not gentle with Shebna. In fact, I really like the work that the translators did. I had the passage from the NIV, and you can just feel the sarcasm in Isaiah's words. He says, oh, you mighty man, God is going to take hold of you. He's going to roll you up in a ball and toss you. Can you picture how awkward it must have been? You're in the office of the most powerful man in the kingdom, and somebody walks in and tells him that. There must have been this really, really awkward silence after Isaiah was done. See, Isaiah isn't just criticizing Shebna. He's openly making fun of him. He's saying, you think you're so strong, you think you're important, God can just roll you up like a piece of paper and throw you in the trash can. So what's Shebna's problem? Why is God angry at Shebna? What has he done wrong? Well, we mentioned already, Shebna is very very proud, very self-centered. Specifically, we're told that Shebna has carved himself, or has had people carve, an impressive tomb for himself. Now, nowadays, that wouldn't be much of a problem. People can choose what the tomb they like. It can look whichever way they choose it. But remember, at that time, this practice is very common, especially among the rulers of pagan nations. We've all seen pictures of the pyramids. That's essentially the kind of tomb that Shebna is planning for himself. Another great empire at the time is the Assyrian Empire. big, very cruel empire, a pagan nation. And in Assyria also, archaeologists have found huge tombs with decorations all over the place and lots of gold, lots of treasures for the afterlife. See, it's mostly a question of status. It's a question of getting people's approval. It's a question of being admired by other people. When people want to show off nowadays, I don't know, what do they compare? Cell phones? Cars? I'm a guy. We compare how much we can bench press. Back then, people compared their tombs. I don't know. It's strange. It's just a different culture, I guess. And that's Shebna's problem right there. He is obsessed with his reputation. He is obsessed with his status. He's very worried about what other people think of him, and he's not worried at all about what God thinks about him. And he's definitely not worried about the people of Israel he's supposed to take care of. Even worse, not only is he proud, not only is he self-centered, but he is modeling his authority after the authority of pagan rulers. He is supposed to be ruling over God's people, and the example that he follows are the Pharaoh and the king of Assyria. When Shebna thinks of the ideal king, he doesn't think about David. He doesn't think about the Messiah. He doesn't even think about God. He thinks about Pharaoh. He thinks of a strong and powerful and cruel man. And God takes that very seriously. See, God isn't just threatening to fire Shebna. He's already told him that he would do that. He's going to fire Shebna. He's also threatening to kick him out of the country. See, in verse 16, God asks Shebna, "Who gave you permission to carve yourself a tomb here?" And that word "here" isn't very clear in English. In Hebrew, it refers to the country. It refers to Israel as a nation. What God is saying is, what are you doing among my people? What are you doing here? Why do you think you're welcome among my people? And then just to make things clear, he says, I'm going to send you out to another country, and that's where you will die. God is telling Shebna, you want to be a violent and cruel and unfair king like the pagan kings are. That's fine. You can do that. But you're no longer welcome in Israel. These rulers, God fought Pharaoh so his people could be free. Rulers like that are not welcome among the people of God. God tells him, you've made your choice. You've decided that you did not want to be a just and fair king. That's your choice. But please, don't ruin it for my people. Don't stay in Israel. And then he adds, I will depose you from your office. You will be ousted from your position. And I will close... I'm terrible with biblical names in English. This is going to be pronounced wrong. I'm sorry. I will clothe Eliakim with your robe and fasten your sash around him. And I will hand your authority over to him. See, the robe and sash, they're the insignia of Shemna's rank. They show that he is the prime minister. There would be the equivalent of, I don't know, maybe a crown or a uniform. And God is telling Shebna, I'm going to take these things away from you, and I'm going to give them to my servant Eliakim. Everything Shebna is proud of, everything he has learned to rely on, everything he's put his hope into, is going to be taken away from him and given to another man. And then Isaiah continues this prophecy, I will place on Eliakim's shoulder the key to the house of David. What he opens, no one can shut. What he shuts, no one can open. In other words, see, up to now, if somebody wanted to talk to the king, they had to ask Shebna. They had to get his approval. And God says, it's no longer going to be that way. From now on, when someone wants to talk to the king, the person who holds the key to the palace will be Eliakim. He is the one that Israel will ask when they want to speak to the king. And it's interesting. This is very often the case in the Old Testament. People in the Old Testament give names to their children that sound a little strange to us. But they choose them because these names have a specific meaning. These names either describe the person or have some sort of spiritual meaning to them. And Eliakim, the name means God has appointed, God has chosen, has called. And I don't think that's random fluke. Eliakim is not just some random politician who's going to replace Shebna. He is the man that God chose. He is the one that God is going to appoint as leader of his people. Someone who will take good care of Israel instead of caring only for himself. Now, Isaiah never mentions this story again. If you have your Bibles open, the next chapter, I think, is a prophecy about the city of Tyre. It has nothing to do with Shebna. And if we just had the book of Isaiah, we would have no idea what happens afterwards. Luckily, elsewhere in the Bible, we're told what happens later on. It's in 2 Kings chapter 18. We won't have time to read it. It's a very long story. Please, when you get home, take the time to read it. It's very interesting. It's almost like reading a novel. If you like TV series like Game of Thrones, it's that kind of story. That's very fun. So in 2 Kings chapter 18, the emperor of Assyria, he's the mightiest person in the world at the time. He has the largest army. No one has fought against the king of Assyria at the time and won. All the people who have gone to war with him have been defeated and have become his slaves. Now, the king of Assyria declares war on Judah, declares war on the people of Israel. And so the king sends a diplomat to try to reason with them, try to avoid war. And this diplomat is the palace administrator. He's the prime minister. And surprise, surprise, his name isn't Shebna. His name is Eliakim. And Eliakim goes to meet the king of Assyria and takes along his secretary, whose name is Shebna. What this means is not only did Shebna lose his job, he became the secretary of the man who replaced him. Talk about an embarrassment. And when you read this passage in 2 Kings, it suddenly becomes obvious that this whole story, this whole political story about Shebna being fired, was actually a sign of God's grace for his people. See, Eliakim comes back from this mission, comes back to Jerusalem. He reports to the king, and it's immediately obvious that he doesn't do things Shebna's way. Instead of going, we're strong, and we can fight for ourselves, and we can defeat the king of Assyria. He says it's no use. We can't do that. We have to learn to rely on God. And the king listens to Eliakim and has all of the people of Israel pray and fast and ask for God's help. And you may have heard of this story before. It's pretty famous. God sends an angel in the night. The Assyrians are camping around the city of Jerusalem. And the angel king kills 185,000 soldiers in one night. And then the Assyrians panic and they flee. And Jerusalem is freed, and none of the Jews had to fight at all. See, the lesson for Israel here is that God will take care of them. God will protect them. God will even defeat the mightiest empire on earth for their sake. But they have to learn to do things his way. Israel cannot afford to do things Shebna's way. They cannot afford to follow their own wisdom. They have to rely on God, or else they will be destroyed. Israel has to give up this illusion that they are strong, They have to understand that their strength is in God. They need to learn to adapt to God's plan, to let Him be in charge. Now, you might be wondering, oh, this is a nice story, about this battle and this war that happened. It's kind of an old story too, right? It was 28 centuries ago. What does that have to do with us? Why are we telling this story again today? Well, you see, without realizing it, Isaiah, when he talks about Eliakim, is also revealing something about Jesus. He's also teaching us about the Messiah. You see, the authors of the New Testament, 8 centuries later, they're reading the book of Isaiah, and they say, wow, what Isaiah wrote here, that applies to Christ. Specifically, it's the Apostle John who quotes from the book of Isaiah and applies what is said about Eliakim, applies it directly to Christ. I'm going to read a passage. It's from the book of Revelation, chapter 3. And John literally quotes Isaiah almost word for word. See if you can spot where the quote is, and just raise your hand if you spot it, all right? Revelation 3, I'll be reading verses 7 to 13. And so John is writing a letter to a church. To the angel of the church in Philadelphia, write, "These are the words of him who is holy and true, who holds the key of David. What he opens, no one can shut. What he shuts, no one can open." Ooh, I see hands. Oh, that's good. "I know your deeds. See, I have placed before you an open door that no one can shut. I know that you have little strength, yet you have kept my word, and you have not denied my name. I will make those who are of the synagogue of Satan, who claim to be Jews, though they are not, but are liars, I will make them come and fall down at your feet and acknowledge that I have loved you. Since you have kept my command," excuse me, "since you have kept my commands to endure patiently, I will also keep you from the hour of trial that is going to come on the whole world to test the inhabitants of the earth. I am coming soon. Hold on to what you have so that no one will take your crown. The one who is victorious, I will make a pillar in the temple of my God. Never again will they leave it. I will write on them the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the New Jerusalem, which is coming down out of heaven from my God. And I will also write on them my new name. Whoever has ears, let them hear what the Spirit says to the churches." So you already spotted where the quote was. It was at the very beginning in verse 7. Jesus is called the one who is holy and true, who holds the key of David. And once again, it's the same words as in Isaiah. What he opens, no one can shut. And what he shuts, no one can open. You see, we today have to learn the same lesson that Israel learned 28 centuries ago. Because God will save us. God will protect us. God will protect us against the mightiest empire on earth if he needs. But we have to learn to do things his way. We can't afford to rely on our own, we can't afford to rely on our own strength. We need to submit to what he has planned instead of trying to impose our plans on him. You see, just like Israel had to forget about Shebna and forget about his way of doing things, we have to give up our way of doing things and put our trust in God. If Israel had followed Shebna, I'll be honest, they never would have beaten the Assyrians. There was no chance. In the same way, there's no chance for us if we want to defeat sin on our own, if we want to be free from Satan's grasp by our own strength. If we do that, the fight's already over. We've already lost. We have to rely on God's strength. We have to do things His way. And His way of doing things has a name. It's Jesus Christ. See, Jesus is the new Eliakim. He's the new God has appointed. He is the one God chose to save us. Remember how Isaiah said, Eliakim holds the key of David. He holds the keys to the palace. Whoever wants to speak to the king has to ask Eliakim. Well, it's the same thing about Jesus, except this time, we're not talking about the king of Israel. We're talking about the king of the universe. Jesus holds the key to the presence of God, and he can let us into the presence of God, but we need to ask him. We need to rely on him and trust him. I'll be blunt here. This is probably the most important part of my sermon. If you forget everything else, that's fine. Just remember this part. You can try to earn God's grace by your own means. Really, really, you can try. Spoiler alert, it's not going to work. You can put your trust in your wisdom, in your knowledge of Scripture, in your intelligence. You can hope that these things will let you reach the presence of God. And you'll be disappointed because it's not going to work. You can try to earn God's approval through your good deeds. You can try to be righteous enough to deserve God's presence. And you're going to be disappointed because it's not going to work. Because Jesus is the only one who holds that key. Jesus is the only one who can give access to the throne of God. See, this is what it boils down to. This is Christianity summed up in one sentence. If you try to come into God's presence by your own means, you're going to fail consistently until the day you turn to Jesus and ask him for help. That's what Christianity is in the end. It's simply surrendering to Christ. It's turning to Christ and saying, I've tried to earn God's approval, and I'm not succeeding. I need your help. I need you to let me into the presence of God. See, no matter how wise you are, how intelligent you are, no matter how righteous you are, no matter how rich you are or how strong, you cannot earn your way into God's presence. But that's good news. You know why? Because you don't have to. Jesus is the one who lets you into God's presence. And no matter how foolish you are or how sinful or how poor or how old or weak, it doesn't matter. That's not how you reach God's presence. None of that can keep you away from God. Because Jesus is the one who gives us access to God's throne. God's acceptance of us does not depend on our performance. Please, if you're taking notes, write that down. God's acceptance of us does not depend on our performance. It depends on Jesus. And it gets even better. Look in verse 7. We're told what Jesus has unlocked, no one can lock. See, Jesus gives us access to the throne of God, and no one can take that away from us. No one can take us away from the presence of God. See, John is writing this letter to a church that's being persecuted. They're being arrested and tried for their faith. And he's telling them, no matter how much you suffer, Jesus is still the one who holds your future in his hand. No matter how much you suffer, nothing can separate you from God's love. No amount of suffering or fear or doubt can separate us from God. The only obstacle that can come between God and us is our own unwillingness to come to him. It's our own heart, our own doubts. Once Jesus grants us access to the Father's throne, nothing can take us away from his presence. Jesus makes that promise to the church in Philadelphia. Verse 12, he says, "The one who is victorious, I will make a pillar in the temple of my God, and never again will they leave it." Those who have been included in God's people are like a pillar in his temple. They will never move. They will never be brought out of his presence. Nothing can take them away from the presence of God. I promised there would be a lesson about Christmas in this sermon. I come from France. The big tradition in France for Christmas is to have a nativity scene. You have a little, little figurines, and you'll have Jesus and Mary and Joseph. There's all sorts of different kinds. I've seen huge ones that would fill this stage, and you have the whole village of Bethlehem, and you have every job is represented. You have the baker and the butcher, and I've also seen tiny ones that would literally fit in my pocket. You know, people just have them in their living room. There's always one thing that is the same with all nativity scenes, is that all the figurines are turned, towards Jesus. They are all looking at Jesus. That's because Jesus is their hope. He's the reason that they have hope. And see, that's the meaning of Christmas. Jesus didn't come to give us a new set of rules to live by. He didn't come as a guru to teach a new religion or just hand out random tidbits of wisdom to his disciples. Sure, he did teach a lot of wise things. He did give us commands. Open your Bibles. There's so much wisdom in there. But that's not what he came to do. That was not his mission. His mission, in the end, was to allow us to see God face to face. His mission was to allow us to enter God's presence. To succeed where we fail. To buy our salvation on the cross. To make us righteous, even though we are sinners. That was his mission. That's why we have hope. That's why Christmas is a time of joy for us. There's a Christmas carol. It's in German. I won't sing it. I won't sing it in German. I'm sorry. I love the words, though. It's a description of Jesus, Mary and Joseph and Jesus. And they put him in the manger. And the song ends with these words. "Please do not be fooled by appearances, because that little baby in the manger is heaven on earth." See, that's the meaning of Christmas. Jesus comes to earth so that we can have access to heaven. He becomes one of us so that we can be united with his Father. That's the whole meaning of Christmas. That's the whole meaning of Christianity. I'd just like to finish by quoting, this is one of my favorite verses in the New Testament. It's in Hebrews chapter 4, verse 16. Let us approach God's throne of grace and confidence. God's throne of grace with confidence, so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need. Amen.